Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, it doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
The Major Spoilers Podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers Podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, inside us all, there are monsters, and Monstrous aims to let hers out.
Mine's actually a chartreuse monster that loves cannolis. There's a new doctor in town, Westworld in the wings, and a full slate of comic book reviews to quench your metaphorical thirst for pop culture. If you love comics, and you know we do too, then you owe it to yourself to grab a comfy spot and prepare for entertainment, erudition, and a frisson of elocution as the Major Spoiler Podcast announces it's on the air.
Welcome to issue 976 of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you so much for downloading and checking us out this week. We're going to get right into it with a little bit of news, Rodrigo.
All right. So we start the news off with the news of the passing of George Perez. The comic book artist passed away last Friday from pancreatic cancer. Perez is best known for his work with the Avengers, Teen Titans, and the 1987 relaunch of Wonder Woman. Perez was also the artist on Crisis of Infinite Earths and gave Lex Luthor his classic battle suit in the pages of Action Comics. Quote, George Perez had an art style that was both dynamic and incredibly expressive, DC publisher and chief creative officer Jim Lee said in a statement. His art was the perfect storytelling canvas for some of the most important events in DC history. While he will be sorely missed, his work will live on with a countless number of fans, as well as all the talent he's influenced over the years. End quote.
Yeah, man, he will be missed. We just lost Neil Adams the week before, and now George Perez. So sad times for big giants in the comic book industry.
Yeah, I mean, if you get a chance, there's actually an episode of Teen Titans Go where George and Marv Wolfman voice George and Marv Wolfman.
Wow.
And there's a couple of them, but there's one that's just a 15-minute joke about George and Marv desperately trying to come up with an idea for the Teen Titans to save DC Comics from ruin. But it's the only time I've ever heard George's voice. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful because George and Marv both have these New York accents and they're just volleying stupid ideas back and forth throughout the whole episode. It's really, really cool.
But that's cute.
Yeah.
All right. There's a new doctor on the way. This past weekend, Nkode Gatwa was announced as the next doctor, replacing Jodie Whittaker for the next round of shows on the BBC. Gatwa is best known for his work on the Netflix series Sex Education. The 29-year-old actor is not the youngest actor to play the doctor. The distinction goes to Matt Smith, who was 26 when he played the time-traveling hero. I suspect, now, the interesting thing is, for those people who don't know, Gatwa is Rwandan descent. He's Scottish Rwandan. So he is got dark skin, and he is not the first person of color to play the doctor. One could look most recently to The Fugitive Doctor. Then we can even go back to Peter Davison as well. And so I think that the people who are going to make a big deal out of this don't need to make a big deal out of this. I think everything's fine.
Well,
and
sure.
I think that this is a kind of a next logical step for Doctor Who. I think there's a lot of people who still kind of wish that Idris Elba was the doctor. But this young actor looks pretty good.
So
yeah, I'm really excited.
So you know what this announcement or kind of the series of announcements that have come up about Doctor Who really made me think about is that Russell T. Davies started the new series.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then we got Stephen Moffat, which I did not like. And then we got Chibnall. Is it Chibnall? Mm-hmm. Which I was just like very indifferent about. Like it just didn't spark joy in me or whatever. And now when they said that Russell T Davies is coming back, because he's coming back, right?
Yes.
I'm like, oh man, I'm one of those nerds that can say like, I haven't liked the Doctor since Russell T Davies was doing it. I hate that we went through two whole things and I didn't like him. And now I'm like, I feel like I'm one of those guys who is like, the Doctor was only good when he was wearing a leather jacket and or Converses.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, and I saw an interview with him, and he wanted to explain. Apparently, his first name is pronounced Shooty.
Oh, okay.
Which is actually pretty cool. But more entertainingly, he was talking about, you know, his fandom of Doctor Who. And of course, you know, he's 26. So it's all, you know, new school Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. But apparently he's also, you know, looking at the old stuff as well. So I'm really, really excited just because it feels like 3 years is about all we get anymore. You get about 3 years of a current Doctor.
Sure.
And then, you know, they move on. And Chibnall's era to me has been all about unfulfilled potential. And I feel like going back to, you know, Russell Davies, for all of the things you can complain about, and there are things to complain about,
sure,
the man knew how to land an ending in a way that none of the modern Doctor Who showrunners have. So I do hope that 13 has a solid ending. I do hope that Jodie can go out on a super high note. I feel like, you know, season 13.
Her stuff is done already, isn't it?
There's still... It's in the can, but there's still stuff we haven't seen yet. We have not seen, I think there may be either one or two more, but we haven't seen the actual regeneration yet, and we haven't seen her final, you know, goodbyes.
Does she have a Christmas special in the can or anything? Changing over?
Well, the no New word. Year's Eve special to this year aired weirdly on New Year's Eve. And I think for the last 3 or 4 years, it's been a New Year special rather than a Christmas special. But I want to say that Jody, season 13 was the 6-episode flux arc. And then there were either 3 or 4 specials throughout 2022. So I would say that if we don't hear something by Christmas, that we're going to have another, you know, it's going to be a spring thing. But I also wonder if they're making this announcement, if they haven't started shooting with Gatwa.
He said he found out. So the announcement came from BBC on Sunday, okay, mm-hmm. to coincide with the BAFTA Awards. He has known that he was going to play the Doctor since February.
Okay.
But they didn't say anything about whether any shooting had begun.
And I know that Russell T may have been behind the rumors that he wanted to bring back David Tennant to play the 14th Doctor after playing the 10th Doctor. I read something where Russell was just like, tee-hee, I may have put out some false leads. Man.
Well, so, again, going back to what you said, Matthew, about Jodie Whittaker only gets 3 seasons, and it like seems like we're only getting 3 seasons out of people. If you go by what Hollywood does, I don't know how, acting unions go other places, but 3 seasons for regular American television is pretty much where the line is drawn between not having to pay you more and having to pay you a lot more to come back seasons 4 right, on. So a lot of this can be down to, hey, I've done my time. I've done my 3-5 years, however long, a BBC season lasts anymore. Right. And it's just too expensive for them to continue on with that character to do that. Yeah. They can go and get somebody new because bing, bam, boom, do some flashing and I don't want to goes. And there you're a new doctor.
Right. Okay. Not everybody says, I don't want to go. But on the heels of finding that new Doctor Who is in the works, I'm also excited to let you know that HBO has now confirmed their fourth season of Westworld is on the way. Apparently, the first of the new 8-episode season is scheduled to hit June 26th on HBO and HBO Max. Joining the cast in season 4 is Ariana DeBose, who I saw last in West Side Story. But as, per usual, there's no real word on what her role is or as far as I can tell, even what's going on in the next season. Season three, of course, aired in the before times, or close to the before times, like early 2020.
Yeah, the final episode of that came out in May of 2020.
Yeah. And I remember I enjoyed season three, but I feel like season three of Westworld is also the point where everybody who was entranced with season one just sort of fell away and started watching other things.
What happened in season two? Is season two where they killed what's-his-face?
Yeah, at the end of season one, they killed Hannibal Lecter.
So I guess I didn't come back for season two then. I guess I knew kind of what some of the stuff was going on, but then I never really came back for season two or three. So maybe I'll go back and recheck those out.
As I've told you many times, the things that you said you knew about season two are in fact wrong, many of them.
I don't remember what I said about that. So
yeah, I don't either. But we had a discussion where you're like, I knew this and this and this was going to happen, and I'm like, but that's
I think didn't they go into War World or whatever they the did. Other worlds were?
They did
with Samurai Mojo. World.
Yes, with Mojo.
Yes, with Mojo.
Yes,
they Samurai did give us some War World. Camelot they did world give us some Samurai World,
Roman World,
and most of that was kind of metatextual because somebody was trying to save Maeve, who had played the house mother of the brothel.
Was that Tandy?
Tandy Newton.
Yeah, yeah.
And they actually stashed Maeve in Warworld to protect her and like hid her programming. So even though, you know, this was another bot that looked just like Tandy Newton, it's, you know, something where, oh, she also secretly has all of the programming that Maeve has. She just has to remember it. So,
yeah, the only thing that I really have a problem with HBO and Netflix and even BBC is that I'm fine with short seasons. Right. And certainly we ended up with a pandemic that really put the kibosh. So I can kind of give Westworld a little bit of forgiveness here. But man, some of these networks, first of all, Netflix waits until after a series has been released before they give the green light for them to start up on a new season, if there's going to be a new season. So it's like, okay, everybody shut everything down. And then in a year from now, we're going to tell you start it all back up and hope that everybody is still available. And I think Westworld, I think suffers from that. I know that there've been a number of shows on HBO that just feel like unless you know that you're going to be in constant production for this, if we have to wait a year, 2 years for the show to come back, people are going to move on to something else. And so hopefully come back for the fourth season of Westworld, but my goodness. And again, I know pandemic, but 2 years
before the pandemic, Westworld had 2 year breaks between seasons.
See,
season one was 2016.
Yeah. See, that's, I feel like a long time. Maybe that's another reason why I didn't come back to season two. It's just like, it's been so long. I really don't care.
I feel like there has to be something in between back when shows used to have like 20 something episode seasons because they wanted to be on syndication. And now when shows have 5 episode seasons, it's like, there should be like a happy medium somewhere where they give us like 8 episodes. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and they have a lot of players and they have a lot of people who are, you know, in season one, I didn't know who some of these people were, you know, Jeffrey Wright, I knew the name, Rodrigo Santoro, I knew the name, but there's even a Hemsworth on the show. Mm-hmm. Although I think the Hemsworth isn't coming back because I think the Hemsworth died. But, you know, you get to a point where when this show started, it had this unknown weird thing going on with a woman named Tessa Thompson, who I don't know if you guys had heard of her, but in 2016, it's like, hey, here's somebody here. And now getting Tessa Thompson is kind of a big get. So I don't know if it's one of those things.
You have to get her away from Love and Thunder.
There's a Skarsgård in there. And there's
on Cinemax, also on HBO Max, is Warrior, which is kind of a Kung Fu, not quite a Kung Fu remake, but it's from the creator and from Bruce Lee's daughter of Kung Fu. And Warrior went for 2 seasons on HBO Max and people really, really loved it. They only just announced like 3 years after the show was done with their second season that, oh, we're going to come back with a new season of Warrior. And it's like, man, it feels like it's almost too late to do that. We were talking in the pre-show about Upload. Season two ended, I want to say last year. And they're just now announcing that, oh, we've just started writing for season three. And it's like, that means it's going to be another year before you get season three out on of that show. And it just feels like there's going to be too much momentum lost when you do that. So hopefully Westworld season four is good, and hopefully a lot of people come back. But I gotta worry when these networks constantly delay the release of some of this stuff, and hopefully, and then are surprised when their fandom doesn't come back. So anyway,
I think that, you know, in the modern streaming era, that may not be the problem that it used to be. I mean, you know, look at Red Dwarf, 19 seasons in 37 years, you know.
Listeners, you can join the conversation about these stories and more over on our Discord server. You can join the Major Spoilers Discord server for free, and we would love to see you join our growing community of awesome spoilerites. There is a link in the show notes, and cat gifts are waiting for your arrival, so get on over there. All right, we're going to jump into some reviews right now. Matthew, why don't you start us off with DC Comics One Star Squadron. I believe this is the final issue of the series that came out last week.
It am. One Star Squadron, number 6 of 6, written by Mark Russell, art by Steve Lieber, whom I really, really enjoy. And I can't remember if it was issue 2 or issue 3, I had previously reviewed here on the Major Spoilers podcast. And I felt like maybe it needed to be revisited because I remember being kind of negative and feeling like, you know, I was mad about the way that issue went. And I was even madder about issue 4 and slightly less mad about issue 5. But when issue 6 came out last week, I realized that why I was mad. And second of all, the fact that I was mad was an intentional decision on the part of the way the creators, the way this story is structured. And I'm still mad about it. But I will tell you that issue 6 is a more satisfying read. It picks up a year and a half after issue 5. During the events of issue 5, the Heroes for You business, where Red Tornado and Power Girl and the other lesser known superheroes were working in a combination telemarketing sort of superhero Uber service, got burned to the ground. Everybody blamed Power Girl because Power Girl had been the villain of the first arc. The only female character in the book, I might add, was being played as the villain and a total backstabbing, you know, climbing jerk. And so this story picks up with Red Tornado a year later, having gotten his life back together, but also trying to figure out what to do now and tracking down all of his old colleagues, finding that, you know, G.I. Robot is now teaching at a night school. And, you know, the heckler is apparently interviewing to work with Lex Luthor, who it turns out was actually the money behind the Heroes for You in the first place. But it has a nice moment in that Power Girl apologizes for her behavior. They kind of in-story justify what was happening with Power Girl, which I like. But then we also do get closure on a couple of the other characters, including a character called Minuteman, who is a full-on Miraclo addict, but has been abusing it for so long that he has exactly 60 seconds of power. And so we find out what really happened with Minuteman. By the way, they killed Gangbuster. If you like Gangbuster, you're the other guy. But they killed Gangbuster, and I'm mad about it. And I feel like this final issue wraps things up quite well. Like, really well. And had it not been 5 issues of crushing existential despair, followed by 20 pages of maybe life's not as bad as you think, I feel like I might have been more on board. You know, I really loved Mark Russell's take on the Flintstones, even though some of it was very flip, kind of, you know, kind of self-help, quickie nonsense, or things like the origin of religion, you know, that were happening in there. They weren't necessarily deep insights, but they were kind of insights to human nature, and they were interesting insights. That was here too, but I feel like the heart was missing, and I realize now that the heart was missing because they were actually trying to make a point about jobs in telemarketing, about jobs, you know, in Uber, about the gig economy. But there's also that moment of, if I'm going to read 120 pages, you can't crush my soul for 100 of them. Now, that said, One Star Squadron number 6 is a good wrap-up. It is really, really well drawn. Steve Lieber draws an incredible Red Tornado. This may be the best Red Tornado I've seen since probably, I don't know, let's say Don Heck back in 88. But it's 3 out of 5 slices of meatloaf. It's the ending that I wanted from the book that I thought this was, but it's not the ending for the book that this was, if that makes any sense. So if you're going to pick this up, know that I liked it better than the previous ones, but also know that my problems are still extant and they killed Gangbuster.
How many slices of meatloaf did you give it?
3.
Okay.
Slices of meatloaf.
Okay. All right. Also out last week from Ablaze Publishing is Bellet and Valeria number 1. Ablaze Publishing, if you haven't been following, they have been taking the Robert E. Howard Conan, Hyperborea, Hyperbaric Chamber stuff, and translating it very, very well into comic book form. The Sumerian series, I think, stands head and shoulders above anything that Marvel is doing with the Conan property right now. Bellet and Valeria is kind of taking two of Howard's properties and mashing them together into an original story. So the Sumerian stuff is just straight up, we're adapting the short stories. In fact, we're putting the short stories in the back of the comic so you can read the short stories side by side with the comic. And I think that's great and wonderful. This doesn't work as well, in my opinion. This is a story where Valeria has been, apparently the pirate queen has been dead and she's risen back to life. And the first thing she wants to do as she climbs out of the ocean is go and find a guy who's hung like a horse and bang his brains out. And it's just like, okay, that's the first 3 or 4 pages of the issue. And then we get onto the ship where they have Valeria captured in the hold and they're returning her to somebody who I guess quote unquote owned her and was expecting to do all sorts of sexy time things with her. And then the rich guy's wizard turns on him and everybody and sends a giant snake and somebody has to expose their breasts. And it just, I don't know. It just doesn't feel like a Howard joint. And it's not, I mean, it's something brand new. In fact, the backup piece in this issue is Howard's article or whatever he wrote in 36 or 37, somewhere around there, on Hyperborea and all of the lands. And so it's a whole world building thing where he talks about that. So this is just, this feels something new and different. And I just really didn't care for it. I think the writing is, or the plotting is fine. I think the dialogue, I could use a lot less of the foul language that is throughout the book, for no other reason than to just have foul language. And it's not like fantasy foul language, like winches and stuff like that. It's straight up F words and B words and all of that stuff. And that kind of turned me off when reading this. So, and the art is fine. I don't know. I just didn't care for this book. And I don't think if you're a Robert E. Howard fan, maybe you will. If you're someone who is all up into, what was that artist's name? Valerio or whatever that artist is that does the fantasy stuff. Or if you're into, who's the other one that did all the fantasy Conan stuff?
Boris Vallejo.
Boris Vallejo. And who's the other one?
Frazetta.
Yeah. If you're into that kind of stuff with half naked ladies and beheadings and all of that stuff, then you might enjoy this, because that's kind of, it feels like it's the same tone. But this to me just didn't work. And I'm going to give it 2 slices of meatloaf out of 5. I really was liking what Ablaze was doing with their adaptation of Animal Farm and what they're doing with Sumerian. This one just kind of fell flat on me. So I'm going to say no thank you to a second helping of this meatloaf. So there you go. Rodrigo, you're going to wrap up our review segment with a look at Speed Republic, which you have reviewed before on this show.
Yeah, we're up to Speed Republic number 4. I've talked about it before. Written by Ryan Lindsay, artist Emmanuel Parascandolo. Put out by Mad Cave Studios. And if you'll recall, Speed Republic is the story of a dystopian world in which the entirety of Europe is controlled by a guy called or known as the Autocrat. And when I first started reading the book, I assumed that that was just like a thing where like the you know, that the writer was like, eventually I'll come up with a better name for the autocrat than the autocrat, and then just kind of was like, well, I'll just call him the autocrat. It wasn't until I was sitting down reading this that I realized that this is a book about driving, and the main villain has the word auto in his name. So I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but if it is, then watch me spend 4 issues getting a joke. So things really heat up in this one. We've been introduced to the sister of the main character, who is now really a main character in her own right. We also find out that somehow the fascist, like, guy that put in this Hunger Games-ish Circus Maximus drive across Europe in order to distract the masses is actually a worse person than we expected. And the way that they rose to power was actually even more bad. But there is some hope. And now not only are the main characters tied up in the race, but they're tied up into a sort of resistance, at least for one specific aspect of the autocrat's control. It's pretty solid. Art is real good. There are some moments where it's kind of tough to tell what's going on. And really that's just because I think that a lot happens in this issue. And I think that it would have benefited a little bit more from like a little bit more room to breathe, a few more shots of like, where's this car going? What's happening? But there's a lot of stuff to cover. I'm going to give it 3.5 slices of meatloaf. I'm enjoying it. Absolutely nothing wrong with this book. If you are looking for something, not post-apocalyptic, but definitely dystopic, this is a good book to pick up.
All right, there you go. Listeners, you can head over to the Major Spoilers website for even more reviews and news and previews. And if you want, you can thank everyone. And we want to thank everyone who supports the show and all the shows in the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. This week, we're sending thanks out to Jesse, to Mark Smith, and to Brainiac, who are our newest bosses. We're waiting to give you a shout out on this show. All you need to do is point your browser to patreon.com/majorspoilers. If you got any questions, comments, etc., you can also drop us an email, podcast@majorspoilers.com. You might hear your question, comment, etc., brought up on an upcoming episode. So there you go. Okay, we are getting into the trade paperback of the week. It's Monstrous Volume 1 from Image Comics, Marjorie Liu and Sana Takeda. All right, so this is set in an alternate universe. This is an alternate history. This is definitely 1900s Asia, but more of a steampunk fantasy Asia.
Sure.
Where you have essentially two groups of people. You have humans, and I'll put that in air quotes. And then you have, what are they called? The Arcana. And they are people that...
The Arcans, I think.
Arcans, okay. They are essentially what you might think of as mutations, people that are different. A lot of them often have some kind of animal hybrid. So there's a little girl that we meet who's got a fox ears and a fox tail. You might see some people who have wings, and you see those kinds of things. The humans and the others do not get along well. In fact, the humans, there's a group of witches that run around and think that if they eat these the mutant people, that they can get this special thing, Lilium or whatever it's called.
Lilium, yeah.
And they can get their powers by drinking that. So that means that they have to kill these people a little bit at a time. Maybe chop off a finger here, an arm here, a leg here, you know, a torso here, ahead. So I got to warn you that there's some body horror stuff that if you're a body horror person, you probably don't want to review or want to read this book. That will be the first thing that I will say. That being said, holy crap, the art in this is beautiful.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I don't, just the colors. I don't know who the colorist is on this. I don't have it here in my notes ahead of time. Sorry about this, but the colorist in here just does a magnificent job. It may be Takeda, but
I think Takeda does all of the art. Yeah.
My goodness. The art is just so beautiful. Page after page after page. Oftentimes I'm just finding myself staring at the intricate detail of the steampunk brass and metal work that's everywhere around you. I'm staring at all of the, you know, Professor Catman, who's telling you the history of this world. The art and drawings in that is just, it's just beautiful stuff. And even the stuff that gets horrifying, like when the monsters come out, when the evil head is revealed, you know, it's pretty to look at.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
What did you think there, Rodrigo? Anything to add on the art side?
No, I do think that it's not just really good, but also both the art and really the color and to a lesser degree, the attention to detail, which is also great, right? There's like backgrounds are like incredibly detailed in this, but it's this kind of like sort of like density that makes and made Monstrous a completely different book from everything else that was coming out, right? It's like if you were at a comic book store and you saw a book that had come out from like Marvel or DC or whoever, and then you saw Monstrous and you opened Monstrous, it's like that book doesn't look like anything else, right? It has kind of its own unique like palette and look. It's like the palette is basically like What if you burned somebody's head in a fireplace that was made of gold?
Yeah. So, Matthew, you want to add anything on to art?
I feel like there are definitely influences from manga and influences that aren't necessarily naturally seen in Western comics that we see. Because there's a point early on where there's a character who is an Arcanic and he has this crazy kind of almost an Oni face and his eyes are pointing outward at different angles. And I'm like, I really feel like I've seen that sort of archetype. And throughout here, there are moments where I feel like I've seen this, or this is referencing, you know, something that specifically appears in comic books and a manga that you don't see in the United States. And so,
oh, this thing is manga.
Oh God, yes.
This thing is manga so hard. It just doesn't look like it, and the art is so like the art is so its own thing that it took me a very long time to be like, oh, I'm reading manga.
Yeah,
right. It sneaks it in, and I think part of it is the way that it so skillfully sews together the basic building blocks of manga with the building blocks of, you know, kind of a United States, not necessarily superhero comics in the US, but definitely indie comics in the United States. This feels like it's got chunks of everything that came out of Top Cow for the last 15 years too. And I just, oh man, you cannot understate how beautiful these issues, this comic is.
Yeah. It's just really good. I mean, this thing gets an A+ just from the art alone. And it's worth picking up. On the story side, this really is a racial story. This is a, you know, it has issues. It also has, you know, the one child. We get this girl who has been struggling all her life with something that happened in her past. And as the story is revealed, we find out that, you know, her mother and one of the lead top dogs in the witch society were friends with one another, and she has some artifact that can help her unlock things, but she has something inside of her that is troubling her, that is consuming her. I mean, she's got one arm, which supposedly has been maybe taken off by one of the witches or taken off in this blast that she saw during the Great War between Yeah. And then we get to this, this idea that, inside of her is a monster, an old one. So this has some Lovecraftian horror mixed in with it, cosmic horror mixed in with it, where there are these old gods that want to come and feast on the humans. And somehow this mask that, her mother and her then friend, uncovered somehow opened this gateway to letting these monsters through, and somehow through the generations, this one monster has been living inside the lineage all the way down to our lead girl. And this monster inside her needs to feed. And it feeds by coming out and eating people, sucking their life force or killing them or whatever. And let's just say there's little children in this book, and at least one of them doesn't come out alive by the end of the second chapter. And that is, if you don't like, there's child torture, there's child killing in this. This is going to be very disturbing for you in that sense. So, there's all sorts of warnings that I want to alert you to in this. Still, the art's amazing.
This is a brutal comic.
Yeah. So, what did you guys think? I mean, I know, Matthew, you're anti-child endangerment stuff. But, you know, here's these two little children that have been locked up and tortured by this horrible... You think that Granny Goodness is bad. There's this jailer in the first chapter that we meet is just like... the worst kind of person in the entire world. So when she dies, it's kind of deserving. But when the two little kids and our lead character make it out of the fortress, out of the prison, and then the girl is like, "I gotta feed," and one of the little kids doesn't make it. It's horrifying.
See, and my thing is not necessarily that I'm anti-child endangerment. I don't like it when it's used as shorthand, as a shortcut to, hey, you want to make somebody evil, threaten a child. Not necessarily even, and I know this sounds terrible, having a story where somebody follows through and eats a child in some ways is actually less distressing to me than having the Joker threaten to, you know, poke a child's eyes out with a pencil. So I definitely see that. And I, you know, one of the reasons I stopped reading Monstrous in probably the first four or five issues was simply because the visuals got more intense than I was comfortable with. And the story remained, I think, a little more nebulous, a little more esoteric than I was able to, you know, come up for every month.
It can be a little tough to follow.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, and again, you know, we're looking at something that has elements, I think, of myth that if you're familiar with the mythology or if you're familiar with the places that these stories come from, feel like they probably make a lot more narrative sense than someone who comes in blind.
I can't remember if it was in the first issue or not, but Marjorie Liu talks about how her parents were in China when Japan invaded and how they, I don't know if they were in camps, rape camps. She talks about rape camps and talks about torture camps and all of these things that happened during World War II. And that definitely influences, in my mind, the kind of the horrific nature of the war and conflict between the two different groups in this book. And so you really kind of see a lot of that in here. And that trauma, I think, permeates the story throughout, which if you kind of understand that background, that maybe this is maybe not an allegory, but heavily influenced by Japanese incursions into China during World War II, then I think that you maybe have a little bit better understanding of where the story is coming from in that sense. Right. But man, it's still brutal. Rodrigo, thoughts?
It's very violent. It's got a lot of stuff going on, you know. There's something about it that is it's just like consistently interesting, because it's the world feels very fleshed out, and the current state of this world is an extremely dire one, right? It's like, forget the fact that there are, you know, monstrous entities that might make an incursion into the world or whatever. That might be worse, but it doesn't seem worse than what the quote unquote, you know, normal denizens of this world are doing to each other, right? So yeah, it's a war story. It's a story about characters that are trying to accomplish something that sometimes aligns and sometimes is perpendicular to the war. And so they kind of end up having allies and enemies on both sides.
Yeah.
And yeah, definitely, I think going into this and thinking, like, knowing that this is a war story, that not that people don't just get killed, but get tortured and or get maimed, is something that helps a lot, right? If you, unfortunately, if you sit down and discover that Monsters is a war story, you might not like it as much as if somebody maybe ahead of time is like, hey, by the way, this is like this is a story that takes place at the beginning of basically this world's World War II, essentially, because there had already been a war, right? And now there have been some like a tenuous peace, and now everything's starting up again.
Yeah, and it does at the same time.
Really good advice.
Yeah, at the same time, even though this is a war story, it's also big epic fantasy, because even though we get the first six issues, and I'll talk about that in just a moment, we get the building blocks of here are these very different characters that are coming together to go on an epic quest to find the other pieces of this mask, to solve the riddle of why this monster and what's her name, Micah are joined together. And, you know, can she put the demon back in the box? Can she make sure that none of the great old ones come through to destroy, you know, this world? So it does set it up for that big, epic, sprawling fantasy that you would see in your Demon Slayer or your Hunter X Hunter or whatever that you're watching in your anime worlds or reading in your manga worlds. So there is that is there, which I think is also the next appeal to this, because this goes on for, oh man, it's like 741 issues, I want to say, is how long it goes. So you've got a lot of reading ahead of you in that sense. So you can get a big story going through, and who knows how it changes. I mean, it may keep the violence up to this level going forward. But I think if you know ahead of time what you're getting into, I think it's a little bit easier to stomach, because for me, I literally got through the first issue and I was like, man, what did I do here? Oh, you know, what are we reading this time? You know, how is this going to be accepted? And then I went back and started reading the next two or three issues a couple hours later. And then it wasn't until Monday that I finished the series, which normally for me, I sit down and read everything in one sitting. But this is one that I definitely had to take breaks and collect my thoughts and kind of reframe about, okay, what is this story doing? What is it telling me? How is this talking about, I don't want to say female empowerment, but you don't have like a lot of male characters in this.
No, most of the characters in this book are women. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to say, okay, what's it saying about the matriarchy, and, you know, what is it talking about? A conflict and people that we view as different from ourselves. You know, there's a lot of things to think about as you go through this series. So in this first volume, it's tough to swallow, but I do like it.
And I think that part of the reason that happens is because it is a first volume. You know, we talk about sometimes a first issue feels like it has to front load a lot of story and a lot of, you know, events to really lock you down. And I remember reading the first issue of this and thinking, my God, there's so much that I don't know. Mm-hmm. They're giving me, they're giving me this glimpse of a, you know, a much bigger world, you know, kind of a world in a, like a, I hate to say the E word, but an Ender's Game sort of feel was what I had. And I remember, you know, reading that first book of that cycle and going, oh man, is there more? You know, sort of that same thing that you'll run into. People are like, hey, you know, the Lord of the Rings, man, you read that first book and you want tons more book. Now, I didn't have that experience, but I definitely feel like this brings that hard. It puts so much, you know, feeling and intensity and horror, you know, not horror in horror comic sense, but horror in a real world horror. Terrible things are happening to people who don't necessarily deserve terrible things happening to them. And it kind of sets you up in a really satisfying way for all of what comes later. And I do appreciate that.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, I did kind of give up on the book.
So going back to the issue one thing, this isn't really a 6-issue trade as much as it's probably a 9-issue trade, because the first issue when it was released was 70 pages long. So basically the triple sized issue. And it's because there is so much world building and backfill that needs to go on to kind of give you an idea of what's going on in this world. And even then, most of the other issues start off with some kind of a flashback to here's what's happened before. Here's what happened when they were digging in, quote unquote, Egypt, Egyptian lands to find this mask or whatever it was. So there's a lot of that. And then there's also these in segments that come at the end of each issue where, like I said, there's these Lord Fuzzy Bottom Professor, Caddington, who goes and says, here's the history of our world, and is doing these little cutesy things talking about how man hybrids came about and how this world was created and a little bit about the old god. So there is definitely a ton of world building going on. And as Matthew said, if you're someone that is into that stuff, I think you'll want to devour all of these issues, because it feels like that is something that continues going forward. Rodrigo, what were you going to say?
I agree. Monstrous is apparently pretty well awarded too. I think it got a few Eisners and like a Bram Stoker award.
Mm-hmm.
So people noticed, it's an interesting synthesis of a lot of things. Again, if you told me, hey, I'm reading this book about a character who has an ancient monster inside of them that sometimes comes out and fights, so they have to control it. But they're also a super kick-ass fighter, and also like they travel around with a little girl who's a fox and a multiple-tailed cat. I was like, okay, so is this put out by Shonen Jump? but when you look at Monstrous, it doesn't look like that, right?
No.
And it doesn't feel like that. I had to, like, again, I was just sort of getting all these cues, and I was like, where do I know these beats from? And it's like, yeah, it's like, because that's the other thing, is that it's a shonen anime, or it's a shonen manga, but it's a girl, right? And overwhelmingly, the cast is women. And that's something else about it that is unusual. I feel like a lot of writers are like, oh, I got one for you. I got a good one for you. What if the bad guy was a lady? Or what if the protagonist was a lady? Or what if the bad guy and the protagonist were ladies? But it's very rare that you get like, what if everyone was ladies, right? Like, what if you looked over the bridge of the Death Star and all the officers were women? What movie is that, right? It's like, that's a different movie. That's a different world, right? And Monstrous is doing that. It's just kind of taking bits and pieces of everything, like all writers do, and like all creators do, and weaving together something that's very unique.
The thing with it's all women, and I know some hopefully not our listeners, but somebody out there is like, ooh, all women in this? I don't want to read that. And it's like, it doesn't come off that way, right? Yes, every speaking line or most of the speaking lines are from women. There's like one or two male characters in here that we get in the 6-issue volume, but it feels very natural. It doesn't feel like they're forcing anything down people's throats. It's, it's not like, there's, for those of you that are just like, oh man, it's gotta be men or nothing. It doesn't feel like that. It feels very natural. And it also is, I find it very refreshing to tell it from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the characters that they are, and part of that is that they're women, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you read tons of fiction where everyone's a dude, and obviously there's something about the fact that they're male that is relevant to their characters, but it happens naturally, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
It's the same thing here, the femininity of the characters is not like on display or being questioned or being flaunted or anything like that. It's like, if you don't go in thinking how many women are in this comic, you could get from the beginning to the end of it of this volume and never think about the fact that the majority of the speaking lines are women.
The one thing that I did find that was kind of funny, maybe telling, maybe on purpose or whatever. You know, normally if you've got your cast of all men, you've got the one sexy lady, right? That is there to be sexy lady because she's sexy lady. There's a character that is one of the hybrid characters that we find out a little bit more about his relationship with another character later on, but he's like beef man, beef sexy guy on the pages. And I'm like, oh, I wonder if that's done on purpose, you know, to kind of be a counterpoint to, okay, for all the Cowboy Bebop stuff out there with your Faye Valentines, here's our take on that. Now you also got the dark brooding guy in the form of the Raven guy. Yeah. The guy with wings. That also is in that as well. So I just really like that a lot.
Yeah, definitely. My favorite moment in this is like, we are introduced to Kat. Mm-hmm, and like one thing that I love about this book is that Kat are a separate sentient race.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you have the elder ones and you have the humans and you have the Arcanians or whatever, and you have the cats. Mm-hmm. And there are and what are they? They're magic cats. And it's like we meet one magic cat, and then later on we meet another magic cat, and that magic cat is like the first magic cat that you meet very much has that sort of like magical animal, like tutor and like mentor to the main character role. The next cat you meet is opposing the characters. And like, I was literally like, oh fudge, look at this cat.
Is this the one that has the eye patch and the sword?
Yeah,
and
the
everything?
Eye patch and the swords. It's like, like I was like, oh no, like I flipped the page and like audibly, I was like, oh no, a cat.
Yeah.
Like they've been kind of hyping cats this whole time. And we just met a second cat. This can't be good.
Well,
and especially once you flip that page, you know that things are really not good.
Yeah. So there's a couple of other things that I find fascinating, too. Especially first one, let's talk about the cats, is you have the humans and you have the Arcanics who really hate each other. Mm-hmm. But then it seems like everybody hates cats. It's like, yes, we understand that the humans and the Archaics have their differences, but at least they can both agree that they both don't trust cats. Which I find, you know, kind of that fascinating twist of either someone has a problem with cats or the fact that, you know, here's this other species that they can both hate on.
The cats occupy, again, a place in fantasy that I love when it's done properly. And it's this like older, wiser race that is not directly involved in this conflict. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
They don't have. Thing. Unlike the humans and the ancients, and by extension the Arcanics, they don't have a city-state, right? The cats don't have, as far as we know, don't have their own city that is also warring with everything else. The cats just exist in nature, sort of in a different state. And some of them decide to help the humans, and some of them decide to help the ancients. Some of them... Like one of them decides to help our main characters for his own reasons. I think the main cat that we have in the party essentially is a boy.
Yeah.
It's a fantasy trope that I really like, is this idea that like, first off, it's like you have this conflict between, you know, the Blurgards and the Flurbots.
Yeah.
But there's more in this world than just those two, right? And the moment that you get so wrapped up in that conflict that you're like, okay, well, you have these two, there's this wild card that is like the other races or the other nations or the other whatever in this world that are not directly involved, but who have essentially agents that mm-hmm. are causing problems or helping you and then causing problems, you know, whatever.
I also find it interesting too that the cats are, you know, while they are supposed to be wise, they're still, I don't want to say dumb, but they're still fallible. Like, oh, who said that? Okay. Well, obviously the poets said that. It's like, okay, who are the poets? It's like the poets are their answer to everything thing. They're not dug from up, right? They're not that, you know, easily distracted kind of thing. But you can tell that they have this wisdom, but they're also naive on a lot of things.
Yeah, they're like a people, right? So they have their own culture, and part of their culture, like we, you know, people have cultural fallibilities, things that our culture teaches us that either isn't right or doesn't, or other people don't believe, right? It's like you go your whole life believing something, then you meet somebody from another culture and you're like, oh my God, this person operates in a completely different way from me.
Yeah.
Right. And I think Monsters does a good job of that, of showing us not just the two sides of a conflict, but also the other groups that are affected by this conflict. And more importantly, and probably where it starts getting really complicated, is all of the subgroups within each of those groups, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because there is, just within the humans, there is like the state and the church, and there's like a lady who is like involved with that, but she's the one that has the like beefy hunk like hanging out with her. Mm-hmm. And their goals are not necessarily parallel to the church's goals, right? Especially when we find out what the Mother Superior's deal is.
So
you have, and that is actually probably what starts to get really dense, is that you don't just have each faction representing each side of the conflict, but each side has actually multiple factions.
Yeah, so like there's nuance. Yeah. There's nuance in the conflict too. So especially when you get to the Arcanics and their Dark Council or whatever that they're trying to take Micah and the rest to, is the they're trying to get them there so that they want her to kill her. And we find out that even inside that group, there are people who are willing to say, maybe we ought to listen. Maybe we ought to not jump so much to conclusions. So
I can imagine that this was actually pretty difficult to read month to month, because you don't just have that, but then the events of each issue sometimes cause characters to change sides. You know, so you're like, you go to the other thing and you're like I was flipping through this, and at some point there's this lady who's important and she gets burnt up, but they save her and basically she's healing. But now she looks completely different because she has like third degree burns all over her body. But now she looks like she's healing from that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I can imagine, it's like, we haven't seen these characters maybe in one whole issue, like, issue two, this happens. Issue three, we don't see them. Issue four, they come back. And I'm like, I was reading the book as we were going. And my first thought when I saw them is like, I remember these characters. But if I was reading this month to month, I wouldn't. Yeah. I would be like, here's some new characters that I have to care about.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty dense. It like, this all feels very dense. Mm-hmm. Just like the art. Maybe because of the art, too. Like, this feels very dense.
I think that's going to be part of the appeal for people too, is that if you want something that you can, a lot of people like put a lot of
teeth into.
Yeah. A lot of people put something a lot contact. Of, put a lot on Saga, for example.
Sure.
I think that this is in that same vein of big epic fantasy with a lot of depth to it and a lot of nuance to it that is worth checking out. Now, I said earlier that, you know, be aware that there's all of this horror and this stuff that goes on. There's a lot of stuff that happens off screen that we don't see. Like, for example, when we talk about the little boy who gets, you know, devoured, we see him being drug off into the darkness, and we don't see, you know, we don't see like, I'm sure if this was manga of some level, we would be seeing, you know, teeth and, you know, stuff being ripped apart. But we just see this boy being drug into the darkness, and then it's later that we see his desiccated body. Again, not cut up, torn up, or anything like that. There are other times where you I think it's the in between issues 5 and 6, where issue 5 ends with our heroes surrounded on all sides by both factions, and you know something bad is about to happen, and you're like, okay, the next issue is just going to be a giant fight. You get to issue 6, and it's like, nope, the fight's over. Mike has already been captured and locked away into a big thing, and we're just moving on. And there are a lot of those things in the story where not showing the stuff is almost as horrific and also as exciting as actually showing that stuff on the page. And I think that really works well in here, especially when you go from, and I think it was between issues 2 and 3 where they do a really big jump back into like some prehistory stuff, some of Micah's past when it was with her mother. that when I first started reading, I was like, oh crap, did I grab the wrong issue? Is there a volume two? And I grabbed issue three of volume two instead of, you know, issue three of volume one. And then I was like, well, let me just keep reading it. And then all of a sudden you're like, nope, this is right on schedule.
Where you were.
So there's a lot of that goes on in the story that I appreciate, because this really could have, I mean, and there's parts where, like, when the demon is coming out of her arm and stuff, where things do get a little gory. And when you find out what's going on with the, as Rodrigo said, Mother Superior, things get a little frightening. I would say some Cronenberg stuff, frightening type stuff, but, sure, yeah, you know, edited for television Cronenberg stuff. So what's everybody's...
Who is airing Cronenberg on television, even edited?
The Thing. I watched The Thing for the first time on CBS.
They do air the Thing on cable, and then they're like, hurry up and get in here, you airhead!
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, there's that kind of stuff that's going on. You still get to see some monsters, but you're just not seeing everything. So, yeah. So what's your bottom line, Matthew?
The thing about Monstrous that I almost feel ashamed that I tapped out. But I tapped out when I was originally reading this and went, nope. And not necessarily because it wasn't enjoyable, and not necessarily because it wasn't gorgeous and well written, but because it was something that really wanted a lot from me as a reader. And it does ask a lot of you. It asks you to remember a lot, to digest a lot, and to accept a lot. And it does it really, really well. So I kind of wish I hadn't stopped. I mean, I have read the last issue, the last four or five issues, actually. And the ending, I feel, is as satisfying as this open. But I will warn you that this is definitely a book that I am recommending. I say you should check out, but also be aware of what you're getting. You are getting a book that's a bit of a commitment, and it's not going to let you sit by idly and just, you know, absorb it as mm-hmm. though it were an issue of All-Star Squadron.
But isn't that also kind of the benefit of this book, is that you can get seven volumes of this, and you know you're in for a story. You're in for something. And I don't know if that's where you get that idea of more bang for your buck, because like you said, if you're just reading, you know, the latest issue of Uncle Scrooge, that's there for just, you know, kind of a real quick, let me read this and, you know, however long it takes, and boom, boom, boom. I don't have to think much in an Uncle Scrooge comic. But this
Scrooge
one requires
is probably
you
a bad
to,
example, because Scrooge does this sort of thing.
No, I don't think it does it like that. No. I would say that if you're
went through the old Great White North.
Just a real quick read kind of thing, that's what you can find in other comics. This is definitely not it. So I don't know, Matthew, does that make it more for people that are really wanting something deep, that maybe not, you know, are maybe casually into comics, but they really like stuff that requires your attention? I think that would probably be more to their liking.
I would say yes. I mean, if you're a fan of big, sprawling kind of, you know, fantasy or swords and sorcery or low fantasy type stories. I don't know if I would call this high fantasy. I don't know. Sometimes I'm a little loose on those definitions, but there's a lot of, you know, fighty sorceressy aspects in here. There's a lot of things that do feel reminiscent of a Lord of the Rings or, you know, some other large world building thing that we, you know, can talk about, since three or four of the major ones have canceled themselves in the last 4 or 5 years. You know, you get to a point where, yes, this is building something huge and complex and a really, really big narrative. And it's doing it in a way that, I mean, you can literally not read a word of these issues and just be stunned. Mm-hmm. Sit mm-hmm. and stare at these visuals and just be like, holy moly, I'm a terrible artist and I should just, you know, die in mm-hmm. a fire, because this is such a gorgeous comic book. I will never create anything this beautiful.
Yeah, no, it's really fantastic. For me, it is something that's going to make you think. You're going to have to take your time with this comic. That to me is not necessarily a bad thing, but if you're in for epic story and epic quest and big journey type things, I think that this is okay. I think this is really good, and I think this is really fascinating. I think there are some things that kind of turned me off, especially when it's like, let's take this little child away in chains and cut off its arm and eat it. I'm kind of like, no, thank you. I don't want that kind of stuff. But it's at one point, it's very horrific when you're reading it in the first issue, but by issue three, you know, the little fox girl is just kind of resigned to saying, hey, our people get eaten all the time. You're going to lose an arm and a leg if you're one of us. And I'm just like, oh, that's also traumatic in itself. So there is a lot of trauma, I think, going on in this story. But I think in the end, it's kind of justified trauma to help you understand and to help the story move forward. I'm going to be thinking about this first volume for a long time, and not in a way that, oh my gosh, why did I read it kind of thing, but more of a, so what does this mean? And so what does that mean? And what are the implications of this? And what are the implications of that? And I'm pretty sure that I'm probably going to end up reading more of this going forward. If nothing else, the art is just magnificent and is so deserving of your attention that I have to say this is a definitely check it out. But if you are into beautiful art, I'd say just buy it for the art alone. But this is definitely something that you should borrow first, read the first volume, and see if it is, if it's for you. Rodrigo, you are getting the final word this week on Monstrous Volume 1.
Yeah, Monstrous is it's a war book. It's a dense book. And I know that there's some people listening that are excited by that prospect, by the prospect of a story and a world that is dark and dangerous, and that there's a lot of lore to sink your teeth into. And this may very well be the comic for you. I know a lot of people were annoyed at the Wheel of Time adaptation. I know a lot of people were annoyed at, like, the, you know, years and years ago, the, like, Sword of Truth adaptation. It's like, if you're looking for your sort of, like, multi-chapter epic media, this might be a good one to get into. If the rest of the volumes go this hard, you know, it's like, this is honestly something that I might, like, I have a list of things that my parents buy me when it's gift buying time, because they have no idea what I like, and my tastes are completely inscrutable to them.
Yeah.
So I might start putting, you know, volumes of Monstrous on there, and, like, you know, get a volume a year from whoever gives me things.
Yeah.
Just to get started on it. Previous, you know, it's a hollow tradition. You know, Hellboy has been there, Fables has been there. So yeah, Monstrous definitely deserves to be up there, I'd say.
Very good. All right. That wraps it up for this issue. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. If you found value in the show, we would love for you to join our Patreon, where you can find even more fun, including Major Spoilers Podcast pre-show, where we talked about Doctor Strange. We talked about Upload. We talked about Cashback, and of all things, Hudson Hawk. What did we talk about? Those things, we're just going to have to go check it out over there at patreon.com/Major Spoilers. So until next time, we know that you love comics. We do, too. We will talk with you soon.
Fat Dick's Ray Vision of Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose, I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic book store guy knew, they kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Find a better way. If I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. If I'm Stark Raven, rich like a man of iron, I might not be surprised if I'm that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. Would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun, being in the Middle East with a King Santo and soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. Whoa, 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 whoa. What a major spoiler.
This podcast is copyright 2022 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener Salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.